Sunrise this week will be at 7:20, sunset at 6:25. A little windy at the start of the week, temperatures around 14 degrees.
Welcome to the latest edition of the Sandwell News for the blind and visually impaired communities living in and around Sandwell. This edition for October the 4th, 2025.
Some stories coming up from the papers. Wednesday 24th of September news, Albion making the best of its lack of strikers. Plan to repair Haydon Hill Hall. Thursday's news, campaign for a couple of quid for a heart defibrillator, women's fear of crime on public transport. Friday's news, be on guard for unlawful robo phone calls. Council reviewing license for Railway Inn after serious crime. Saturday's news, memories of Bobby Gould's last days as Albion manager in 1992. Monday's news, Albion's draw against Leicester. Plan to regenerate site near new Metropolitan Hospital to build new homes. Suspension of newly elected Labour councillor. Tuesday's news, dog helps to detain kidnap suspect. Why wasn't Hillsborough game not halted during emergency?
All those stories and more coming up courtesy of Express and Star Publications. And as usual, we have the week ahead's TV and radio listings and one, two items from TNF soundings and not one, but two match reports about the Albion's doings this week, which are a bit more hopeful. Here's the first day's news.
Hi, everyone. It's Mia. Today I'm going to be reading some newspaper articles from Wednesday, the 24th of September, from the Express and Star. I hope everyone's well and enjoying their week so far. Let's begin. West Brom is recognised for fair pay pledge. West Brom Building Society Foundation has been accredited as a living wage funder by the Living Wage Foundation. The foundation, which was established in 2023, has been recognised for its commitment to fair pay and financial well-being in the communities and organisations which it supports. The Living Wage Funder accreditation encourages all salaried posts supported through the Foundation's grant funding to be paid at least the real living wage rates of £12.60 per hour outside London and £13.85 per hour within London, as set by the Living Wage Foundation. West Brom Building Society Foundation was set up to provide funding to support three key areas: promoting housing and affordable accommodation, the prevention of financial hardship through education and training, and supporting well-being. Jonathan Westhoff, trustee of West Brom Building Society Foundation, said, "This recognition means a great deal to us because it shows that we meet the highest standards in supporting fair and equal pay. As a living wage funder, we encourage all salaried roles, supported by our grants, to be paid at the real living wage rates." Albion making the best of it. Ryan Mason insists Albion making the best of their striker shortages. Albion are light in forward areas, and the goals are yet to flow with 7 scored in 6 games. Much of the onus has been placed on the shoulders of £4.7 million summer buy Orn Hegabo. Joss Myers' involvement has been minimal while returning from a long-term absence, and Daryl Dyke is injured. "Josh is getting there," Mason said. "He's had a long time out. I know his record last season in terms of scoring goals, and I also know that from January onwards, he didn't play a minute for us. At the moment, we've only got 2 strikers. We've got Josh and Bo Hegabo. So that's what we're dealing with right now. And we're making the best of it. Josh, like everyone, has got an important role to play and hopefully can contribute as much as possible going forward." New club may open in derelict bar where cannabis farm was found. Application asked for permission to sell alcohol and play music from 8 a.m. to 3 a.m. A new late-night venue could open on the site of a former Smethwick bar just months after police discovered a £3,000 cannabis farm. Castria Haxiage has applied to Sandwell Council to open the new Westside Lounge on the first floor of the former Avenue Bar and Grill in Roll Street, Smethwick. The cannabis farm was discovered in August, just a year after the club closed down when it was the scene of an attempted murder following an early hours shooting. The new application asks for permission to sell alcohol and play live and recorded music at the venue every day from 8 a.m. to 3 a.m. The proposed opening hours are 8 a.m. to 3:30 a.m. every day. West Midlands Police carried out a raid at the former bar and grill on August 1st, finding 300 cannabis plants, money, and an imitation gun hidden inside a printer. A 22-year-old man was arrested on suspicion of producing cannabis, possession with intent to supply drugs, and possession of an imitation firearm, but later bailed pending further inquiries. Avenue Bar and Grill had its license revoked by Sandwell Council in July 2024 after the shooting. A report from Sandwell Council says the bar's license was suspended on June 18th, pending a full investigation. Jack Cabea was one of three men identified by police over the attempted murder at the Bar and Grill on June 17th. After learning of an associate's arrest, the 21-year-old Cabea, previous convictions for drugs and knife offences, fled to the Democratic Republic of Congo using his brother's passport. He was arrested at Gatwick Airport on his return from Qatar around 3 weeks later. Last October, Cabea of Kitchener Road, Selly Park, admitted two charges of possessing someone else's identity document with intent and was sentenced to 22 months in prison. Plan to repair famous 18th century house. Proposals to carry out repairs and improvements to one of the Black Country's most famous historic houses are to be considered by planning chiefs. Jane Honey of Sandwell Council's Museum Services has applied for planning permission to carry out a number of improvements to Grade 2 listed Haydon Hill House in Halesowen Road. The proposals include new handrails to the front door, front and side terrace steps, and two galvanised steel handrails of a snake design, each supported on two galvanised steel decorative brackets bolted to the stonework. The front door handrails would be fixed to the stone door surrounded at the top and to the capping of the stone wall at the bottom. Miss Honey said the handrails would be 2 inches in diameter and made from solid steel, and the posts would be based on designs at St Luke's Church in Cradley Heath prior to its demolition. Haydon Hill House, now open to members of the public as a museum, was built for George Alfred Haydon, who inherited the 55-acre estate in 1877. But he decided he did not want to live in the dilapidated 17th century Haydon Old Hall next door. Two drivers caught doing 98 miles per hour in racing hotspot. Two drivers who raced each other along Kenrick Way in West Bromwich have received suspended prison sentences and each face a court bill of more than £2,000. They are the latest people brought before the courts by Sandwell Council for breaching the Black Country-wide street racing injunction. Appearing at Birmingham High Court on 12th of September 2025, James Reynolds and James Holding admitted breaching the injunction. They accepted that their speed and manner of driving on July 28th, 2025 potentially presented a danger to other road users or a danger of damage to property and a public nuisance. Police estimated they were racing at speeds of at least 80 miles per hour to 98 miles per hour on Kenrick Way, which has a 40 miles per hour speed limit. Mr. Reynolds, aged 33, of Durham Road, Wensbury, and Mr. Holding, aged 36, of Black Lake, West Bromwich, were each sentenced to 42 days imprisonment, suspended for 12 months on condition they abide by the injunction or any subsequent amendment to the injunction. They were also ordered to pay court costs of £2,406.30 each. Councillor Suzanne Hartwell, Sandwell Council's deputy leader and cabinet member for Neighbourhoods and Community, said, "I welcome this latest court result, which sends a further message to street racers or car cruisers that this dangerous and antisocial behaviour will not be tolerated. As we have tragically seen before in Sandwell, street racing puts people's lives at risk and can lead to devastating tragedies. Street racing along Kenrick Way has been a particular concern for residents. We will continue to work with police and other Black Country councils to respond to people's concerns and protect our communities."
This is Jan Lloyd reading articles from the Express and Star on the 25th of September. A couple of quid for DFib, in memory of Mark. An Albion fan is leading a fundraiser to support a defibrillator campaign in memory of Mark Townsend ahead of the first anniversary of his death. Rich Sant, 55, has organised a bucket shake outside the Hawthorns before kick-off against Leicester City on Friday night as part of the Lawrence Legacy campaign, which is pushing for defibrillators to be installed in each corner of every football stadium. Sunday marks the one-year anniversary of Mark's death at Hillsborough, home of Sheffield Wednesday. He fell ill in Albion's away end and collapsed during the first half as play went on, and later died in Sheffield's Northern General Hospital. In the wake of his death, Mark's brother Steve asked why play was not paused while the incident occurred and why emergency response took a disproportionate amount of time to reach his aid. Mark's inquest begins in Sheffield on Monday and is expected to last for 10 days. Baggies supporter Sant, a friend of Steve's for several years and who got to know Mark, requested permission from the Townsend family to become Albion ambassador for Lauren's Legacy Defibrillator campaign, set up last December by Paul Gregory, whose daughter Lauren Walker died after a short illness in 2023. Football fan Lauren had previously been revived by paramedics using a defibrillator. Sant, from Walsall, told the Express and Star, "Mark's inquest starts on Monday and we just want to get his face back out there so people will remember him. I was reached out to by Lauren's Legacy as Paul is a Sheffield Wednesday fan who was there that day. We're trying to raise a little bit of money. I've spoken to the family, Mark's brother Steve and wife Marion, to ask their permission, which they agreed to. Marion is coming for the game. I've been in touch with the club for permission. A picture of Mark will go on the screen at the 58th minute and is in the programme. It just refreshes people's memories of who he is. If we can save one football fan in a stadium from the same happening as did to Mark, then we've done something. The fundraiser is bring a couple of quid to support the defib, and there will be a bucket of collectors outside each of the stands at the Hawthorns before the Foxes clash. There will also be the opportunity to scan a link to also visit a donate page online. All proceeds go to the hashtag One in Every Corner campaign." The article is accompanied by a picture of a very happy Baggies fan, Mark Townsend, with a great big smile on his face, clearly at a football game. Trial starts as three men and teen are accused of murder of father. The trial of three men and a child accused of murdering popular father of two, Matthew Adams, after a row at a West Bromwich pub 2 years ago has started. Mr Adams, 33, died 4 days after being attacked on March the 19th, 2023 at the Gough Arms, Hilltop, West Bromwich. Known to friends as Whacker, the father of two returned battered and bloodied to his home after being attacked in the early hours following an argument in the pub. Mr Adams felt increasingly ill over the next few days and an ambulance was called 4 days later on Thursday, March the 23rd. However, his untreated injuries had got worse and he died in hospital. The police arrested three men, a woman and a youth in the weeks following Mr Adams' death, and Mark Shorthouse, Ryan Stanley, John Wise and a teenager who cannot be named was arrested. Those four were charged with murder, manslaughter and violent disorder in December. Nicholas Stanley was also charged with violent disorder. The five are on trial at Wolverhampton Crown Court. Mark Shorthouse, aged 54, of Church Vale in West Bromwich, Ryan Stanley, aged 31, of Peel Street, West Bromwich, John Wise, aged 42, of Kingston Road, West Bromwich, and the 17-year-old boy from West Bromwich deny murder, manslaughter and violent disorder. Nicholas Stanley, aged 40, of Peel Street, also denies violent disorder, and the trial continues. I Was Locked in a Cell Haunted by the Spirits of a Miscreant Young Monk by Dan Stacey. Ghost stories have never really appealed to me, but I suppose it's easy to say that from the comfort of your own home. That view was tested, though, on my recent trip to a Heritage Open Day at Haydon Hill House in Cradley Heath for a guided tour of the grounds. It included a rare trip down into the cellars beneath the old hall, and an underground passage that is said to be haunted by the spirits of a young miscreant monk who, legend states, was buried alive in the grounds and his lover, Eleanor, who died of a broken heart. Tucked away between residential lanes in Cradley Heath is the entrance to Haydon Hill House, next to Haydon Hill Cricket Club and Leisure Centre. Located right next to Haydon Hill House is Haydon Old Hall, also known as the Tudor Hall, and this is the building our tour guide, Stuart Roberts, focused upon. Outside, we were told about how in the early 20th century, a fallen tree damaged the front of the house and forced the then owner, George Alfred Hayden, Hayden Best, to redesign the entrance. And what a good job he did. The house is impressive to look at, and while it has required maintenance, there is still a feeling of looking into the past when stood outside. That feeling continues inside. Once you enter through the low doorways without banging your head, it's clear that the house was built in a time when the average height of people was little more than 5 feet, as a lot of crouching is needed to complete the tour. We headed down a set of spiral stairs into one of several cellar rooms. We were told stories about the various jobs people would have had to do in order to ensure the house continued to run smoothly. One room was designated to chopping and storing wood or coal during the Victorian era. We were also told that in 1977 a fire in that room almost caused the entire house to collapse, and that students on a YTS scheme were responsible for rebuilding the damaged area of the house, ensuring it could remain open. Like the work done on the house's exterior, I found it very impressive that such work could be done without changing the character of the place. The wood room is where the first whispers about Eleanor and the monk were heard. We had walked down a passage to enter the room, and after finishing up in there, we headed back up it and through more storage rooms, this time for food, drink and other general supplies. We were also shown remnants of secret trapdoors that would have been used by the servants to come in and out of the cellars more quickly, and told that a lack of spring water sources in the area meant everyone, including children, drank ale as a means of staying hydrated. Finally, we arrived at the cell, which proved as dark and disturbing as expected. It was only a holding cell for local magistrates, so prisoners could spend no more than a few days there at a time, but I imagine it would have been a rather painful existence. In fact, I was locked in there for just a few moments, and having been told the story of the bodies supposedly buried a matter of yards from me, I would call it an interesting experience, to say the least. If you're a believer in ghosts, or even just intrigued by fantastical tales and local history, a trip to Hayden Hill House and Old Hall is one to make. There are public open days throughout the year for you to look around the house, while the museum offers a lively programme of activities for all ages to enjoy. And the article is accompanied by three photographs. One where the entrance that was damaged by the fallen tree is shown, with people standing outside looking at it. One with the guide in the wood room, showing where they used to chop and store the wood, with a big basket of wood being chopped. And the last one, which is probably the most amusing photo of them all, is reporter Dan Stacey, where he's locked in the cell under Hayden Hall as part of the Heritage Open Day tour, looking a little bit worried about it, if I'm honest. Women's fear of crime on public transport is holding back economic growth, says Mayor, by Mark Andrews. Women's safety fears when using public transport is stifling economic growth, says elected Mayor for the West Midlands, Richard Parker. Mr. Parker said concerns about public safety was forcing women to pass up on vital opportunities, such as employment and training, stifling their potential and holding back economic growth by up to 3.7% of GDP. He made the comments during the launch of West Midlands Safer Travel Partnership's new 3-year plan to reduce crime and antisocial behaviour on the region's public transport network and make passengers feel safer. Artificial intelligence will be used to identify antisocial behaviour hotspots, while drones will be used for larger operations. Bus shelters, tram stops and bus stations will be redesigned to prioritise safety of women and girls travelling alone. This will include making sure areas are well lit, promoting public help points with video links to female control room staff, as well as more training for staff on the public transport network. The body is made up of Transport for West Midlands Police, British Transport Police and transport operators. Mr. Parker went on patrol with transport safety officers to see how they patrol the network and keep people safe. He said, "We know people can feel less safe at night, so we're taking action to reassure them. That means looking at how we design stations, stops and shelters, and how we deploy our transport safety officers. While incidents of crime and antisocial behaviour are rare, we have a dedicated team working round the clock to keep people safe." He said women relied on public transport far more than men, making 30% more trips, but their journeys were often limited due to their safety fears. "This is not just a matter of personal security, it's an economic and social crisis, holding back economic growth by an estimated 3.7% of GDP, he said. West Midlands Police and Crime Commissioner Simon Foster added, "Making our public transport network safer for women and girls is a top priority. By combining better design, new technology and dedicated officers, we are tackling crime and antisocial behaviour while ensuring passengers feel safe and confident wherever they travel." Mr. Parker said there were just 2.2 acts of antisocial behaviour for every 100,000 journeys, but a survey of public transport users found that there was a huge difference in perceptions of safety between travelling during daylight hours and at night. People also felt trains were safer than trams or buses, and waiting at bus stops was a leading concern. In response to these concerns, the partnership has drawn up an action plan to improve safety. Greater use of AI will be made to analyse vast amounts of CCTV footage and identify issues, with the use of drones to provide additional coverage during larger operations. And the article is accompanied by a picture of the patrol team: Lee Clark, Isha Shima, Mayor Richard Parker, Mohammed Nashbindi and Nikodim Swazek, all standing in their uniform, apart from Mr. Parker, obviously. On this day, September 25th, 1066, Harold of England defeated the Norwegians under Harold Hardrada at the Battle of Stamford Bridge, Yorkshire, unaware that William of Normandy was preparing to invade the south coast. 1660, Samuel Pepys drank his first cuppa after reading that tea made the body active and lusty. 1818, the first blood transfusion using human blood as opposed to earlier attempts with animal blood took place at Guy's Hospital in London. 1872, Sir Charles Cochrane, English impresario dubbed Britain's greatest showman, was born. From 1914 to 1949, he presented some of the best musicals and reviews, including five by Noel Coward, two by Rodgers and Hart, and two by Cole Porter. His chorus girls were known as Mr. Cochrane's Young Ladies. 1885, it snowed in London, the earliest recorded winter fall, despite reports that on June 12, 1791, there had been snow sighted over the capital. This was recorded as late summer, not winter snow. 1897, Britain's first motor bus service started in Bradford. 1933, more than 25,000 people queued to see the Shroud of Turin when it went on show to the public for the first time in 400 years at Turin Cathedral. 1962, Sonny Liston won the world heavyweight boxing title, knocking out Floyd Patterson in the first round in Chicago. And in 2023, actor David McCullum, who became a teen heartthrob in the hit series The Man from U.N.C.L.E. in the 1960s and was the eccentric medical examiner in the popular NCIS 40 years later, died aged 90.
Hiya, it's Gavin, and I've got some readings for you from the 26th of September. Be on guard for unlawful robo phone calls that impersonate real persons. People are being urged to be wary of robocalls, as companies have been criticised for taking advantage of the elderly and vulnerable. The public should be on their guard against unlawful automated calls that impersonate real people. It comes as two green energy firms have been fined for more than £500,000 for using them. The Information Commissioner's Office, ICO, said it had fined Home Improvement Marketing Limited, HIM, based in Pembrokeshire, £300,000, and issued it with an enforcement notice ordering it to stop making the calls. It has also fined Green Spark Energy Limited, GSE, based in Durham, £250,000 for making 9.5 million automated marketing calls. Both firms used an avatar software which gave the call recipients the impression they were talking to Joe, Helen or Ian from the UK. They were, in fact, listening to scripted lines recorded by voice actors and played by call agents abroad. In the case of Green Spark Energy, 497 complainants who received the calls included cancer patients and elderly people. The aim of the call was to arrange an appointment with a surveyor to attend the property. A recording of one of those calls found that they included misleading statements suggesting fiberglass insulation was causing damage or mould and could be a potential health hazard. Home Improvement Marketing made 2.4 million automated calls on behalf of the company, resulting in 274 complaints, claiming it was offering solar panels from Energy Hub and an energy saving team. In the UK, companies must obtain a recipient's consent before making automated marketing calls. Andy Curry, head of investigations at the ICO, said robocall technology was making it harder for the public to spot automated calls and reports into the ICO. He said, "We've heard disturbing reports of how unscrupulous companies are using robo-technology to fool elderly and vulnerable people. We understand how distressing these calls can be and will work on the public's behalf to catch those responsible." The ICO has released a list of tips to help the public to determine if they have received a robocall, which can include slight pauses before responses, a noticeable delay between what you say and the responses you hear as the agent selects the next pre-recorded clip, and repetitive answers to questions. So that was slight pauses before responses, a noticeable delay between what you say and the responses you hear as the agent selects the next pre-recorded clip, and repetitive answers to questions. Council is reviewing licence of pub after police links to serious crime. Sandmore Council is reviewing the licence of a West Bromwich pub after a senior West Midlands police officer linked the premises to serious crime after a stabbing. The Railway Inn, Harford Street, is popular with patrons who partied the night through until the early hours of the weekends. However, West Midlands police were contacted by nurses at Midlands Metropolitan Hospital after a man presented himself suffering from knife wounds. The stabbing victim claimed he had been attacked at the Railway Inn at closing time on Saturday, September the 13th. Sandmore Council's licensing team published notice of a summary review into the alcohol licence held by the owners of the Railway Inn. The notice said an application for a summary review has been made by a senior police officer of West Midlands Police. In their opinion, the premises are associated with serious crime and serious disorder, or both. On September 13th, West Midlands Police received a call from West Midlands Met Hospital reporting a male had self-presented with a stab wound at the Railway Inn, Harwood Street, West Bromwich. It was ascertained that the male had been in the Railway Inn, Harwood Street, West Bromwich, and as the premises were closing, the victim was stabbed outside following an altercation involving patrons from the venue. However, customers who enjoy frequenting the Railway Inn and oppose any plans to close the venue can make their views clear to the decision makers. New COVID strain, Stratus, to look out for as cases soar. A new COVID variant is now the most common strain across the UK, health officials have warned. The XFG strain, nicknamed Stratus, makes up nearly 40% of current COVID cases, according to the latest figures from the UK Health Security Agency, UKHSA. The World Health Organization is keeping a close watch on the variant after rising cases and hospital stays were reported in parts of Southeast Asia. Cases in Britain remain steady, but doctors say the risk has not gone away. With winter approaching, people are being urged to stay alert to COVID symptoms and check if they qualify for a vaccine this autumn. Dr. Amanda Doyle, NHS England's National Director for Primary Care and Community Services, said, "The threat from flu and COVID is very real, and each winter we see hundreds of thousands in hospitals because of these viruses. Vaccination is our best defence and can save lives. I urge mums-to-be, parents of young children and teenagers and anyone eligible to get their jabs as soon as possible." But what is Stratus? Stratus is a subvariant of Omicron, formed from earlier strains LF.7 and LP.8.1.2. It was first spotted in a sample on 27th of January 2025. There are two types, XFG and XFG3. But XFG now makes up almost 30% of all recorded cases, making it the UK's leading strain. COVID symptoms remain much the same. A new cough, high temperature, loss or change of taste or smell, sore throat, headache, tiredness and nausea. Stratus may show one early sign, a hoarse or raspy voice before the usual symptoms begin. This autumn, the jab is offered to adults aged 75 or over, older adult care home residents, people with weakened immune systems, including some children. The rules have changed since last year, when people aged 65 to 74 and those in wider risk groups were also included. We are giving people power to transform neighbourhood. Chancellor visits region to announce £100 million of funding for five deprived areas. Chancellor Rachel Reeves and Communities Secretary Steve Reid were in the West Midlands to announce £100 million funding to revitalise five deprived neighbourhoods: Friar Park in Wensbury, Southern Blagnall in Walsall and Low Hill in Wolverhampton will each receive £20 million over the next 10 years, along with Birch and Coppice in Kidderminster and Woodside in Telford. The money will be paid to the local councils, but how it is spent will be determined by neighbourhood boards made up of residents and the constituency MP. The ministers were at the Park Lane Centre in Woodside, Telford yesterday, where they announced £3.5 billion to be shared across 169 neighbourhoods across the country. They met with Snow Hemmings, project officer at the centre, and three teenagers who were helping to run activities at the centre as part of a vocational training programme. They said the money would be used to revive high streets, parks and public spaces. Communities will also be given new powers to save local pubs and libraries and block unwanted betting and vape shops, as well as fake barbers. The funding comes on top of an existing £1.5 billion, which is being shared across another 75 neighbourhoods. Prime Minister Sir Keir Starmer said it was an opportunity for true patriots to reshape their communities. Separately, a further 95 areas will receive an immediate £1.5 million cash injection to upgrade public spaces with new green spaces, play areas and sports and leisure facilities. Councils will be given the opportunity to seize derelict buildings and boarded up shops under community right to buy and compulsory purchase powers. Antonia Bance, MP for Tipton and Wensbury, said it was an opportunity for the people of Friar Park to take charge of their community. Local people know their area better than anyone, and the government recognises this, she said. Now is our chance to take control and improve Friar Park by making the big decisions ourselves, not by letting other people do for us. An extra £2 million every year for the next 10 years is a huge investment in Friar Park. This is our money to decide how it's spent on anything that will make our community better. All ideas are welcome, and this is our chance to show that Friar Park can achieve together. Serena Brackenridge, MP for Wolverhampton North East, welcomed the funding for Low Hill. This £20 million will change lives over the next decade, and I will be making sure it is spent where residents and local people need it the most, she said. Mr Reid said the communities had been selected on the basis of deprivation levels, and the aim was to restore local pride. Those are the people who are most likely to see their high streets in severe decline, so closed down shops, metal shutters pulled down in front of them, perhaps a proliferation of vape shops, dodgy barbers, where nobody seems to be getting their hair cut, gambling shops and bookies, and people feel absolute despair when they see their high street and their town centre turning into something like that. Multiple approaches from Westminster haven't worked, and the key problem is that local communities haven't had a big enough say. It's local people that know best what needs to change to restore pride in their own area. Each area will get £20 million. They decide how it's spent, but they also get new powers so they can limit the number of those kinds of unwanted shops that are happening in local areas. They can use those compulsory purchase orders, taking over those empty shops and turning them into something of value to the community, to bring the vibrancy back to the high street and restore that sense of pride. Chancellor Rachel Reeves says we're giving local people the power to transform their hometowns, giving them more control of how money is spent, where they live, so that together we can invest in Britain's renewal and build an economy that rewards working people. There's an image here of a lady standing in front of a green area, with a big, large grassed area, and it's Sabrina Rackenridge, MP, saying that he's celebrating £20 million funding for central government for Low Hill.
Hello everyone, this is Linda, reading from Saturday the 27th of September's Express and Star. Townsend family appreciate kindness after Mark's death. Albion fan Steve Townsend said he had been bowled over by the kindness shown to his family as the one-year anniversary of his brother Mark's death approaches. Sunday marks a year since Mark Townsend, a huge Baggies supporter, lost his life in Sheffield as a result of a heart attack at Hillsborough Stadium in the city. The following day will begin a 10-day inquest into Mark's death. The 57-year-old BMW factory worker, who had attended the fixture with nephew Matthew, collapsed in the 3,000-strong Leppings Lane end midway through the first half against Sheffield Wednesday. It took in excess of 10 minutes for medical aid to reach him. Mark's younger brother Steve and his son Matthew have continued to cheer on Albion, having returned to the Hawthorns in the Birmingham Road end, moving five rows forward to new seats. The trio's old seats have been taken by a father and his children, something Steve appreciates, as well as being inundated by kindness and well wishes. "You try not to dwell on it too much," Steve said on the eve of his brother's anniversary. "You can't live in the past. It's been hard, I can't lie. There is no way of sugarcoating it. Death is death, and you will miss them. I miss him every bloody day." The kindness of certain friends, even lads we only know from up the match, have made it a lot easier. "There was one game where Matt had gone away with his missus and I thought, sod it, I'll go upon my own. And two lads next to us wondered where he was and they said, no, you don't sit there on your own. And they got me to go and sit next to them to have a bit of banter." Silly things like that. People will always ask after the family as they walk past. Work friends too. We both worked at the same place. A few lads are having a drink to remember Mark on Sunday. They are heartfelt things that show people still have the time of day to remember. Mark's widow Marion is over from Ireland, where she was born and now resides, and watched last night's match against Leicester, where Mark, who lived in Albury, was paid tribute to on the big screen and in the matchday programme. Steve and Marion will attend the inquest from Monday. There was a bucket collection outside the Hawthorns last night to raise funds for Lauren's legacy, backing the One in Every Corner campaign. It was launched by Sheffield Wednesday fan Paul Gregory after the death of his daughter and is raising funds to have life-saving defibrillators installed in each corner of every football stadium of the English League. The campaign fits. It was made after somebody else lost someone they cared about as a legacy for that person. Steve said of the Red Sky Foundation fundraiser, which has made £21,000 since it launched last December, "Even if we make enough money for one defibrillator, and it's in Mark's memory, that's a legacy for me." 70 years of service. Heroes Award for couple devoted to helping improve the lives of others. Brenda and Eric Moore were the toast of the Express and Star Black Country Heroes Awards. They have helped others for 70 years, working tirelessly to improve services through the YMCA. And now they have landed a special recognition award for their dedication, which continues today. Mr. and Mrs. Moore, who are both in their late 80s, have given unswerving support to the organisation in the Black Country. From securing a new site at Carter's Green in the mid-60s, leading its transformation into a thriving hub of activity and accommodation, Mr. Moore helped shape the very foundations of what is now the flagship building of YMCA Black Country Group. The organisation also brought them together as a couple, marrying 64 years ago. Mrs. Moore joined the YMCA in 1968 and championed the inclusion of female members, forming a group that would go on to provide food parcels, Bibles and hope to those in need. Express and Star editor Mark Drew, who presented them with their award, told the audience at Molyneux, "Their energy, wisdom and generosity have shaped the lives of countless individuals across the Black Country. Their impact is immeasurable. Their legacy is undeniable." The couple said they were humbled at the award, which they said also went to all those who volunteer for the YMCA. Mr. Moore said, "We have always tried to do what's best and help others. We have loved doing it." 12 awards were given out at Molyneux at an event hosted by Dickie Dodd. They ranged from Community Champion to NHS Hero and from Fundraiser of the Year to Future Star and Child of Courage. Day Baggies fans took out frustrations at Gay Meadow. No, it's not Scottish fans wreaking havoc at the old Wembley. These are Baggies fans on the rampage at Gay Meadow. First, they tugged at the station end goalpost and then down it came. as Shrewsbury Town hosted West Brom in a match in which nothing rode on the result, but which gave away fans a chance to release some pent-up frustration. West Brom officials had feared there might be trouble at the Baggies' last game of the 1991-92 season, and they weren't wrong. The tone was set when supporters arrived carrying a coffin bearing the name of the manager, Bobby Gould, who could later reflect that the Gay Meadow was the place of both his footballing birth and footballing death. It was at Town's ground that he made his Football League debut as a teenage apprentice for Coventry City in 1963. When he spent the entire 90 minutes trying to find a way past Shrewsbury centre-half Peter Dolby. And it would be only a few days after the fans' protest at the 1992 Gay Meadow match that he would be sacked at West Brom, boss. Gould, whose playing career had included a spell at Wolves, was never a good fit at the Hawthorns after being brought in to succeed Brian Talbot, and had been advised against taking the job by his mate Don Howe. However, he jumped at the chance, arriving in February 1991. But he couldn't save Albion from their lowest ebb, dropping down to the third tier for the first time in their history, despite being unbeaten in their last nine games of the season. It was Gould's first relegation of any kind. The following season, hopes of a quick return were dashed and he couldn't even get them into the promotion playoffs. Even before that, various factors contributed to a toxic atmosphere. He had stormed out of the Player of the Year awards and was getting it in the neck from the local media. He had never seen eye to eye with assistant Stuart Pearson, the fans' choice for manager, who had acted as caretaker boss before his arrival. So, to that eventful match on Saturday, May the 2nd, 1992, in which he arrived at Shrewsbury's ground to Gould out chants and would leave with them ringing in his ears. The pitch invasion by Baggies fans came at or just before the end of the match. According to one supporter, it ended 5 minutes early. Albion won 3-1 and finished a disappointing seventh in the third division table, while for their part Shrewsbury Town were already doomed to relegation. Gould recalled it was tradition on the last game of the season for all the travelling supporters to get dressed up in holiday swimwear and sunglasses. So, to try to soften the blow, I asked the players to wear sunglasses and help share the disappointment with the fans. On appearing on Gay Meadow with the lads before the game, little did I know that the 3,000 or 4,000 that had travelled up to Shropshire had bought a cardboard coffin with Rest in Peace Bobby Gould on the side. There is a follow-up to that story, as in the 1995-96, when I was manager of Wales, I returned to Gay Meadow to watch a player. Little did I know that the first person to greet me was the groundsman. He led me over to his shed, opened the door, and there before my very eyes was the coffin. It should be mentioned that in another interview, Bobby remembered the tale slightly differently, saying it was while returning to the Hawthorns as Cardiff boss to watch one of the midfielders that the groundsman told him he had his coffin in his shed. In any event, while that day in Shrewsbury over 30 years ago was indeed a portent of his imminent death at WBA, new life would follow, as Gould, who is now 79, went on to various other managerial roles with inevitable ups and downs, as well as becoming a successful football pundit. Father told doctor he was beaten by 8 people before he died. Father of 2, Matthew Adams, told his doctor he had been beaten up by 8 people days before he died, a court heard. Mr. Adams, 33, was attacked at the Gough Arms pub, Hilltop, West Bromwich, in the early hours of March 19, 2023, and died 4 days later. 4 adults and a teenager are on trial at Wolverhampton Crown Court in connection with the murder of Mr. Adams, known as Wacka to friends. Mr. Adams, from the Yew Tree Estate on the Walsall-West Bromwich border, died as a result of his injuries. On March the 21st, he had had a phone consultation with a doctor from Stone Cross Medical Centre and requested pain medication. Dr. Lubna Sayed was working as a locum at Stone Cross Medical Centre when she spoke to Mr. Adams. In a statement to the jury, Dr. Sayed said, "I spoke to him on Tuesday, March the 21st at 10:41 a.m. The appointment was by phone. I had a telephone consultation. He requested pain medication. He told me he had been beaten up by 8 people a few days previously and was having left-sided lower rib pain. He denied having symptoms of swelling, bruising, rashes or inflammation. I advised him to come in and be examined, but he did not want to. I prescribed him Cocodamol and told him to present himself at A&E or phone 999 if symptoms continued after taking the tablet. Mr. Adams did not tell the doctor about other symptoms which could have pointed to a more serious problem, she said. He did not say anything about passing blood. Mr. Adams' condition worsened over the next 48 hours and he was rushed into hospital where he died. He also told his friend that he had been beaten up at the Gough Arms and would be unable to start his new job due to his injuries. Darren Mann said, I knew Matthew for 12 years and worked with him. I'm also the godfather of his children. After the disorder at the pub, I texted him to say wishing him well with his new job. He said, I can't start because I've been beaten up. He added, he then sent me pictures. These showed swelling of the face and a thick lip. I could tell he had been in a brawl. After I got the pictures, I phoned him straight away. I asked, where did this happen and who did it? He said it was at the Gough pub and it was people I did not know. He had an argument with one and everyone joined in. He did not tell me what started the argument. He told me he would call me later, but he did not. A few days later, I saw his ex-partner at the Archer's Yew Tree. She told me he had been given tablets. She said I should go up to the hospital. Mark Shorthouse, aged 53, of West Bromwich. Ryan Stanley, 30, of West Bromwich. John Wise, aged 42, of Sandwell, and a 16-year-old boy from West Bromwich, who cannot be named for legal reasons, having been charged with murder, manslaughter, and violent disorder. Nicola Stanley, aged 39, and of Sandwell, has been charged with violent disorder. The trial continues.
This is Alison, reading a selection of articles from the Express and Star, dated Monday, the 29th of September. Similar tale as baggies serve late punishment, the debrief. Albion were left with late frustration for the second straight home game, as Leicester struck in stoppage time on Friday night. After carving out a mountain of second-half chances, Albion were made to pay for their errors in front of goal, as Leicester found the net deep into stoppage time. After a late defeat to Derby, it was the second successive game where Albion have lost points late on. It left Ryan Mason frustrated in arguably his most emotional press conference to date, with the Baggies boss left feeling like his side dropped 2 points. Here are some talking points to come from the draw. A positive and a negative. There have been times in recent years, and even in Mason's short time in charge, where we have been feeling that Albion aren't able to create enough. In certain games, there have not been a lot of clear-cut chances. They have had opportunities they should be taking, but nothing really clear-cut. However, in this one, they had more chances in the game, clear-cut ones, than they have had in other matches under the new head coach. They had 6 really good opportunities in the second half, and not taking at least one of them has cost them the game, make no mistake about it. But turning a negative into a positive, it is pleasing to see them carve out that much. It is hard to remember when they last did that at the Hawthorns in recent times, because under previous bosses, chances have been at a premium. It will happen and drop, and they will blow a side away one day, but that makes it no less frustrating. Stats don't lie, better without the ball. Albion looked on course for their 4th win of the season, and they should have got it. Most in the ground will know that. If they did, all 4 of their games will have seen them win with less possession. The stat is kind of irrelevant to an extent now, with Leicester netting late, but what it does show is that Albion are arguably more creative and look more likely to score when they haven't got more control of possession. Essentially, they are better on the counter-attack. Madger rusty, but edging back. Josh Madger made his longest cameo from the bench as he edges closer to a potential first start since earlier this year. He looked sharper with some of his classic flicks round the corner as he brought other players into play. It was what we expect from Madger. His 2 big contributions in the game should have been 2 goals. He did well to steer a Mikey Johnston cross at goal, but his second chance was gilt-edged. He had to score from the follow-up to Jed Wallace's free kick. He knows it, everyone knew it. It is down to match sharpness and being a bit rusty. Madger, with a run of games under his belt, scores that every day of the week. Mason's emotion says it all. Mason has been pretty straight with a lot of interviews. He is one focused individual, plays a lot of things with a straight bat, and you can understand why. But I think a mark of the game and what unfolded was underlined by how frustrated he showed he was after the game. He wasn't ranting and raving, but it was a bit more emotive than he has been in previous press conferences. He gave a superb line on how he was waiting until Saturday to speak to his players, in case he says something he regrets. It was a stark line, and underlines his frustration. He knows his side are on the right track, but it makes this result, and the Derby one, no less frustrating. Angela, the secret is all in the stretching. TV presenter urges everyone to stay active through dance. Beloved TV presenter and former news anchor Angela Rippon has truly done it all. She made history as the first female national news reader on the BBC's 9 o'clock news, has fronted a wide range of popular programmes, including Antiques Roadshow, Top Gear and Rip Off Britain, and, just 2 years ago, she became the oldest contestant ever to compete on Strictly Come Dancing at 79. Now, with her 81st birthday fast approaching, this passionate presenter has no intention of slowing down. The thing that keeps my energy levels flowing is that I do things that I enjoy, and I'm uniquely privileged that for almost 60 years now, I've been doing a job that I absolutely love, and for whatever reason, I'm still being able to do it, says Rippon. I'm still working in television, interviewing people, presenting things, and that keeps my mind active. It keeps me alive physically, getting up early in the morning, working all day, working on scripts and having to read lots of material. One of her absolute non-negotiables is her daily morning stretches. If you ever watch a cat get up from sleeping, the first thing they do is stretch, and that's what I do, shares Rippon. I do a series of stretching exercises for 10 to 15 minutes every single morning of my life, wherever I am, even in small hotel rooms when I'm filming. I get everything moving, everything working, and that's how I start my day. That is my non-negotiable. She shares that an interview she conducted in her 20s with Eileen Fowler, a leading figure in movement and exercise in Britain during the 40s and 50s, continues to inspire her steadfast dedication to staying active. Eileen said, "You have to remember the body is a machine. It is full of millions of moving parts, like any other machine. But also like a machine, if you don't keep those parts moving and exercised and working, they will seize up, they will rust," recollects Rippon. Eileen really encapsulated how I feel about myself and my own attitude towards my own mental and my physical fitness, and that has stayed with me all my life. It has never changed. I really do believe in keeping fit as we get older, because it helps to strengthen your core, improve your balance, maintain your posture and your gait, which means that as you get older, you're less likely to have a fall. If you keep your body active and moving all your life, you're less likely to find that your life and your lifestyle is restricted in any way. Another key part of her fitness regime is dance classes. I try to ensure that each week, on at least 2, if not 3 days, I do some other form of extended exercise. So I will still go to ballet class when I can, says Rippon. What I've got out of dance is that it has helped me keep fit and have fun. Now I'm about to be 81 and I'm still incredibly fit, very supple, very flexible, and it's enabled me physically and mentally to still be very fit and very alert. Her love for dance stems from going to dance classes as a child, and the TV presenter says she is thrilled that she has been able to weave this passion into her wide-spanning career. Even though I'm not a professional dancer and never have been, I've managed to do what the Japanese always say very often, which is, if you want a good life, try to combine a passion with your profession. And I managed to do that, says Rippon. My passion for dance has worked its way into my profession as a broadcast journalist, with programmes that I've done, films that I've made, and things that I've been involved in over the years. I've danced twice at the Royal Variety Show. I danced with Eric Morgan and Ernie Wise famously on their Christmas show in 1976. And then 2 years ago now, I danced on Strictly Come Dancing. The presenter is passionate about the life-changing effects of dance, so is spearheading a national Let's Dance campaign, to encourage everyone, particularly older adults, to experience the benefits. She knows firsthand how dance classes can connect people and help forge friendships, saying, "People are meeting each other and laughing. You are never lonely or isolated in a dance class." Plans to regenerate eyesore sites near hospital with homes. A council will use compulsory purchase powers as part of plans to regenerate several eyesore sites around a new hospital. Sandwell Council will use a compulsory purchase order, CPO, to buy 8.5 acres of land around the new Midland Metropolitan University Hospital in Smethwick to make way for new housing. A number of crumbling units and former factories would be demolished as part of the work before being handed over to developers. The sites include old units and a bus depot in Grove Street and a former factory in nearby Cranford Street. The site in Grove Street would favour between 70 and 85 flats rather than homes, according to the Council's 2022 Grove Lane Master Plan, with a five-storey block facing the new hospital and homes facing Halberton Street. The Master Plan also includes a new school on the same site. The borough was awarded £18 million by the government in levelling up funding in 2024, which, after a range of delays and talks, can now be spent by March 2028, 2 years after the original deadline. Sandwell Council will also be spending £2 million towards the work. The huge £750 million Midland Metropolitan University Hospital on the border of the Black Country in Birmingham opened last October after years of delays. The huge site will include a new teaching campus and is expected to include a new urgent treatment centre, but these plans are also delayed. Up to 800 houses and flats are expected to be built around the hospital as part of the regeneration plans. Sandwell Council has already agreed to use compulsory purchase powers to buy another empty factory in Cranford Street to make way for new housing. Early plans said the site would be used for up to 170 homes, but that has now been cut by more than a third to 100 units. Robbery suspect arrested within hour. A man has been arrested in Sandwell on suspicion of robbery within an hour of police officers receiving a 999 call alerting them to an assault. West Midlands Police has said that a 29-year-old man was arrested on suspicion of robbery after they received reports of car doors being tried in Sandwell and a victim being punched in the face. Police responded to Stonehouse Crescent, Wensbury, at around 5:50pm on Wednesday, to reports that a man was seen trying car door handles on the street, and after finding a car unlocked, a number of items were taken. After confronting a man, a victim was punched in the face before the man ran off from the scene. Upon searching the area, the suspect was found and then arrested only an hour later by the Sandwell response team. He remained in custody while police inquiries continued. A force spokesperson said, "We were called to Stonehouse Crescent to report a man was seen trying car door handles on the street, and after finding a car unlocked, several items have been taken. Following a confrontation, the victim was punched in their face before a man ran off. The suspect was found and arrested just an hour later by the Sandwell response team." Suspension of recently elected Labour councillor. Sandwell's Labour group has been plunged deeper into turmoil after another councillor was suspended by the party. Councillor Kirat Singh, who represents Wensbury South, has been suspended by the Labour Party just 2 months after he was voted in at the borough's local council elections. He was part of a new intake of candidates, which Labour described as a refreshed local team who stood ready to open a new and positive chapter for Sandwell. The reasons for his suspension have not been made public. It is the latest catastrophe to hit the struggling Labour group, which has been mired in controversy for years, amid claims of corruption, bullying and racism. Speaking in April ahead of the elections, Labour Party leader Sir Keir Starmer said the excellent, diverse group of candidates proved that his party was making changes in Sandwell. But Labour lost 9 seats to the Conservatives and has stumbled from one disaster to another since, with a further seat turning blue last week, when Emma Henlon won the Tividale by-election. The council's chief executive, David Stevens, is set to depart, leaving the authority's top two officer posts vacant, while 6 other positions are held on an interim basis.
Hello everyone, this is Pam reading some articles from the Express and Star, Tuesday the 30th of September. Inquest to open on patient who choked. An elderly patient died after choking on food at the New Midland Metropolitan Hospital. A two-day inquest for Rashida Sultana, 76, will be held at Black Country Coroner's Court in Oldbury from tomorrow. That's the 1st of October. The Birmingham pensioner died on November the 20th, 2 days after she was admitted to the new hospital in Smethwick due to concerns that she had suffered a stroke. A pre-inquest hearing was given a provisional cause of death as choking on food. Dog helps detain kidnap suspects. A heroic West Midlands police dog has been praised for his part in detaining suspected kidnappers in Tipton. PD Nero and his handler were responding to reports of a kidnapping in Tipton when the alleged offending vehicle was found in a car park. Police say four males tried to exit the vehicle as they approached, but were challenged by Nero and then detained. Officers said that numerous weapons were also recovered from the scene. West Midlands Police shared a photo of PD Nero on social media on Sunday afternoon. The social media post praised his heroic part in helping to detain the suspects. The force has, however, since confirmed that the suspects will face no further action on the allegation of kidnapping. Rape in Park case is sent to Crown Court. A man will appear at Crown Court next month accused of raping a woman in West Bromwich. Mohamed Surov is accused of the offence in Kenrick Park on September the 9th. He appeared at Walsall Magistrates Court on September 13th for his first hearing and again yesterday. The case has now been sent to Wolverhampton Crown Court. Surov, aged 26, was remanded in custody and will appear on Monday, October 13th at Wolverhampton to enter a plea. Why wasn't game stopped during a medical emergency? Baggies supporters were respectful and helpful as off-duty GP attempted to help. This article is by David Higgins. A supporter who was desperately attempting to save a dying football fan at a West Bromwich Albion game told an inquest they should have stopped the game. Richard Stones, who is a GP, painted a chaotic picture at Hillsborough after Mark Townsend, 57, collapsed with a cardiac arrest. They were both among West Bromwich Albion supporters at Sheffield Wednesday's Hillsborough Stadium on September 28, 2024. Dr. Stones said the care received by Mr. Townsend at the ground was among the worst he had seen and a shambles. He told an inquest that he had been a West Brom supporter for 50 years and was a regular at home and away matches. He said he was a GP with the Ministry of Defence, had experience of working in an A&E department and also was a football club doctor. The GP said Mr. Townsend was sitting about three or four seats away from him in the upper tier of the Leppings Lane stand when he became aware that something was happening. He said Mr. Townsend, who was from Oldbury, was grey and had no signs of life when he approached to begin CPR. He described how stewards did not appear to know what to do and that medical care did not arrive for many minutes. Dr. Stones said the fans around him were chanting for the referee to stop the game and a couple of supporters went onto the pitch to try to halt the match. He said, they should have stopped the game. Asked whether the actions of the crowd around him did anything to contribute to the poor response he saw, Dr. Stones said, the Albion fans did nothing wrong that day. He said the supporters around him were respectful and helpful. Mr. Townsend's wife, Marion, left the hearing while Dr. Stones was shown CCTV footage of the incident. The doctor was asked by Ian Perkins for Sheffield Wednesday Football Club whether he could have been mistaken about some of his recollections, given the intensity of the events around him. Mr. Perkins suggested it took about 4 minutes rather than 10 minutes for the first paramedics to arrive by Mr. Townsend. He also suggested the paramedics the GP saw walking across the pitch were not the ones who were first on the scene. Dr. Stones, who described himself as just a good Samaritan bystander, said, "I wasn't aware of everything that was going on." The GP described how he and off-duty paramedic Chelsea Jones took turns to do chest compressions on Mr. Townsend, as he knew immediately that he was in cardiac arrest because of his 25 years of medical experience. He told Sheffield Coroner's Court on Monday, "We are doing CPR, we are screaming out to get some help, and nothing came." Barrister Peter Wilcock, KC, thanked the doctor for all his efforts on behalf of Mr. Townsend's family. The inquest is being presided over by Sheffield Senior Coroner Tanyaka Rawdon and is taking place after concerns were raised about the response to the emergency. Peter Rhodes column. Peter Rhodes gives his views on the news and life in general. Today, cows, cards, and a new job vacancy in Gaza. Keir Starmer sings the praises of digital identity cards. He declares, "Digital ID is an enormous opportunity for the UK." Well, if it's such an enormous opportunity today, why wasn't it even mentioned in Labour's manifesto for the 2024 general election? For that matter, what is the point in a manifesto at all? Time after time, from imposing 20-mile-per-hour speed limits to scrapping winter fuel allowance and launching ID cards, issues which have a profound effect on our daily life never appear in any manifesto and are not even debated but are simply announced in Whitehall like diktats from Putin's Kremlin. The argument that ID cards would help deter illegal immigrants is simply ludicrous. As a reader put it 3 years ago, cards would be pointless because nothing would happen to people who hadn't got them. And while Starmer and co. talk bravely of inclusion, any internet-connected ID system would exclude the estimated 5% of Britons, mostly the elderly, who have no internet connection. The government promises consultation on this issue, I bet, and would these consultations be invited by text, email and social media, but definitely not handwritten by any chance? If Whitehall really wants to stop migrants vanishing into the black economy and being exploited on starvation wages, it should look no further than its own cattle tracing system, which tracks livestock with a unique number on an ear tag and a physical cattle passport. Keepers must register births, movements and deaths. It's a proven system. Some years ago, a farmer suggested to me that the best way to keep track of migrants would be to give every newcomer on arrival not an ID card, but a cow. Tony Blair is said to be willing to sacrifice his time to end the war in Gaza and help run the place until a permanent government is in place. Very noble, but is this not a job demanding someone who is skilled in the dark arts of compromise and difficult diplomacy, currently without a job and eager to rebuild his reputation? You can't keep a good Mandelson down.
Welcome back to the Express and Star pub quiz. And this week's round, it's general knowledge. Question one. Montpellier is an area of which Midlands town? Question two. Which river in Greek mythology serves as the boundary between the living and the dead? Question 3. The majority of the Carpathian mountain range lies in which European country? Question 4. At which UK national park could you see a boat called a wherry? Question 5. Which British artist painted the 18th century work A Rake's Progress? Question 6. Angora wool comes from which animal? Question 7. Which foodstuff takes its name from the Tamil for pepper water? Question 8. Which country's Formula One Grand Prix is held in Lusail? Question 9. What kind of fruit is a Merton Glory? And question 10. How many pegs are traditionally used in the game of quoits? How's your general knowledge? Click to the answers to find out. Here are the answers for the general knowledge round. Question 1. Montpellier is an area of which Midlands town? Cheltenham. Question 2. Which river in Greek mythology serves as the boundary between the living and the dead? The River Styx. Question 3. The majority of the Carpathian mountain range lies in which European country? Romania. Question 4. At which UK national park could you see a boat called a wherry? The Broads. Question 5. Which British artist painted the 18th century work A Rake's Progress? William Hogarth. Question 6. Angora wool comes from which animal? A rabbit. Question 7. Which foodstuff takes its name from the Tamil for pepper water? Mulligatawny. Question 8. Which country's Formula One Grand Prix is held in Lusail? Qatar. Question 9. What kind of fruit is a Merton Glory? A cherry. And question 10. How many pegs are traditionally used in the game of quoits? 5. Thanks for joining me in this week's quiz. I'm Sarah Ann, and I'll be back next time. Bye!
Albion Match Report. A 93rd minute own goal from Nat Phillips gifted Leicester City a dramatic draw with West Bromwich Albion in the Championship. A superb solo goal from Samuel Illing Jr. early on appeared to have been enough to earn Albion their first win against the Foxes at the Hawthorns for 15 years. Leicester had passed, pressed and probed in search of a response, but their control of possession and tempo of the game lacked a cutting edge. An early second-half edger from Yannick Vestergaard was their only effort to press Josh Griffiths into action before the stoppage time equaliser. Phillips's inadvertent own goal, which Bobby De Corva-Reed created with an acrobatic volley for the Foxes, was made all the more painful for the hosts after they missed a chance to make it 2-0 moments earlier. After visiting keeper Jakub Stolarsik had pushed out a Jed Wallace free kick, striker Josh Madger wastefully blasted the rebound from a few yards. Leicester boss Martin Cifuentes stuck with the same team held to a goalless draw by Coventry City a week earlier, while West Brom's head coach Ryan Mason made 3 changes following their defeat at Leaders Middlesbrough. On loan Southampton defender Charlie Taylor started on his debut for the hosts, whilst Aston Villa loanee Illing Jr. was also brought into the 11 for the first time. And the former Juventus winger wasted no time in marking the occasion in style. Meeting a deft flicked pass from Orn Hegbo, Illing Jr. outran Boubakary, Sumer and skipped around Belgian defender Wout Vaes before prodding his finish past Stolarczyk. The 10th-minute header opener had come against earlier run of play, with Jordan Ayew dragging a shot just wide inside 3 minutes. And after Illing Jr. broke the deadlock, Jordan James had an effort deflected over the bar and Harry Winks hit a volley wide as the Foxes searched for a first-half equaliser. West Brom continued to soak up pressure after the break and Leicester's quick passing and fluid football created few serious threats. Vestergaard was presented with the best of them, but he could only send his close-range header into the arms of Griffiths. The Baggies went on to create numerous chances, with George Campbell lashing a chance into the side netting and Isaac Price hitting the tame effort straight at Stolarczyk before Marger had a volley deflected wide. Substitute Marger then went on to squander his huge chance in the 90th minute, while Toby Collier curled an effort just wide. But in added time, a deep cross from Abdul Fatawa was met by substitute Dakova Reid, whose flying volley was turned into his own net by Phillips. Ryan Mason said, "It's disappointing. We deserved to win the game. We did more than enough to win the game, so we are hurting. The performers deserve so much more. The lads played incredibly well. It's clear we created enough chances to win the game, and 1-0 is a dangerous scoreline. I can't fault the lads' effort. I can't fault the lads' quality. We had so much personality, and I thought we played an extremely good game against a really good side, and we were the better team and should have won the game. It's something we have to improve on if we want to be successful in this league. Of course, you need to take those opportunities. You need to kill a game off, and we were made to pay for it."
When you asked to receive recordings produced by the Sandwell Talking News, you gave your name and address so that we could send you our memory sticks or CDs. This information is stored in a secure database and address labels are also stored in a secure location. Having left our premises, the address labels and postal wallets are then under the protection and care of Royal Mail. Your contact details are only used for sending you our memory sticks or CDs and will never be forwarded to a third party. If you ask us to stop sending Sandwell Talking News to you, your contact details will be deleted from our database and your address labels will be permanently destroyed. We promise and assure you that we take data protection seriously and make every effort to meet the requirements of the Data Protection Act. If your circumstances do change, you move home, change your phone number, or wish to unsubscribe to the Sandwell Talking News, please call the office on 0121 525 4810 or email sandwelltn@gmail.com so that we can make the necessary changes.
Some audio described TV programmes for the next week along with radio programme highlights from Talking News Federation. Search for publications TNF Soundings to hear these directly on their website.
TNF Soundings.
Now for the audio described television programmes for Saturday 4th October to Friday 10th of October. Compiled by Lisa and read by Chris. For an amusing start to Saturday, Channel 4 has three popular comedy series. Everybody Loves Raymond airs at 8:05 a.m, followed by a double bill of Frasier at 9, and two episodes of The Simpsons at 10. Meanwhile, on BBC One, Rick Stein is in Cornwall at 11:30, cooking Cullen Skink, otherwise known as fish stew. Then at 1:30, Charlie Ross presents Bargain Hunt from Shropshire. There's rugby league action on BBC Two at 5:15 p.m. with live coverage and commentary of the Super League playoff semi-final, followed by a documentary, Secrets of the Jurassic Dinosaurs, at 7:40 p.m. It must be autumn, as episode 2 of Strictly is on BBC One at 6:20, and this week things get serious as one couple will be voted out in Sunday's results show. In total contrast, catch the second part of Nine Bodies in a Mexican Morgue at 9:25. I'm guessing there won't be as many sequins as that. BBC One also has Match of the Day at 10:30 with lots of football commentary and analysis. For movie lovers, there's Dune Part 1 on ITV1 at 9:15pm, epic sci-fi drama starring Timothy Chalamet. Channel 4 is showing period spy adventure The King's Man at 9pm, starring Ralph Fiennes, followed by Salt, an action thriller starring Angelina Jolie at 11:40pm. Now for Sunday. Daytime options are a little thin on the ground, but BBC Two has the ever-reliable Nadia Hussain on her British food adventure at 11:30am this week, visiting the home counties. Staying with BBC Two, there's a classic western to enjoy at 3:50pm with Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, starring Paul Newman and Robert Redford. Catch Strictly Come Dancing the Results Show at 7:15 on BBC One. And at 9:05pm, find out who wins the Battle of Hastings in King and Conqueror, the final part of the historical drama starring James Norton. BBC Two has a travel-themed evening starting at 7:20 with Eva Longoria searching for Spain, in which the actor continues her cultural journey in Andalusia, followed by Pilgrimage, The Road to the Scottish Isles at 8pm, and a brand new series at 9, Rob Brydon's Honky Tonk Road Trip, in which the actor and comic explores the roots of country music in the American South. Over on ITV1, Vernon Kay presents M&S, Dress the Nation at 6:55, followed by Beat the Chasers at 8pm, the popular quiz hosted by Bradley Walsh. Then there's a new crime drama at 9 when Saran Jones and Jodie Whittaker star in Frauds. Channel 4 has documentary Educating Yorkshire at 8pm, in which newly qualified maths teacher Mr. Geary deals with some challenging students. Turning now to this week's soap schedule. On Monday, it's EastEnders at 7:30pm on BBC One, and Emmerdale and Corrie on ITV1 at 7:30 and 8pm respectively. Tuesday has EastEnders at 7:30pm and Emmerdale at 7:30pm. Wednesday, it's EastEnders at 7:30pm with Emmerdale and Corrie at 7:30 and 8pm. Thursday is EastEnders at 7:30. Friday, it's Emmerdale at 7:30 and Corrie at 8pm. Moving on to Monday, the 6th of October. Daytime schedules feature Homes Under the Hammer at 11:30am on BBC One. And later at 2:30pm, catch Amanda and Alan's Italian Job, in which the duo renovate two different bathrooms, followed by a new series of The Repair Shop at 3:45pm. The evening highlight on BBC One is part two of Blue Lights at 9pm, whilst over on BBC Two, Jim Al-Khalili continues his investigation into the evolution of our brains in the Horizon documentary Secrets of the Brain, also at 9pm. This is followed by Kunk on Earth at 10pm, in which Philomena Kunk explores the origins of two of the world's great religions. Catch episode two of Frauds on ITV1 at 9pm, or over on Channel 4, Joe Wicks is Licensed to Kill at 8pm, in which he carries out a provocative stunt designed to convince the government to change food laws for good. Staying with Channel 4, Social Media Monsters is a new series which airs at 10pm, examining serious crimes where social media has played a significant role. And on to Tuesday, a classic daytime double bill on BBC One with Homes Under the Hammer at 11:30am, followed by Bargain Hunt at 12:15pm, In similar vein, David Dickinson presents Dickinson's Real Deal at 2 p.m. This week the team are in Preston. BBC One's evening offering includes Stacey and Joe at 8 p.m. How Will Stacey Fare at the BAFTAs? Followed by popular school drama Waterloo Road, now in its 16th series at 9 p.m. It's all round to Nigella's on BBC Two at 7 p.m. for Nigella at My Table, as she serves up herby lamb and garlicky potatoes with feta and oregano. Then at 8 p.m. in Digging for Britain, Alice Roberts investigates an intriguing discovery in an Oxfordshire quarry. Dear Old Alan Titchmarsh returns on ITV1 at 8 p.m. in Love Your Garden. The team head to Leicestershire to surprise 96-year-old Gordon with a stunning garden transformation. Let's hope it's a pleasant surprise. Cozy viewing continues on Channel 4 at 8 when it's Pastry Week on the Great British Bake Off. Noel Fielding and Alison Hammond lead the bakers through savoury plats and gala pies. Then things get a little more adventurous at 9.15 in a new series of Worlds Apart. Six young Brits who have never travelled alone are paired up with six pensioners who thought they'd never travel again. It's Wednesday with yet more Homes Under the Hammer at 11.30 on BBC One and an extra dose of David Dickinson at 2 p.m. on ITV One. The repair shop is back on BBC One at 8 p.m. when former children's TV presenter Jenny Hanley brings in a threadbare stuffed monkey with a royal connection, followed by the much-heralded new series of Celebrity Traitors at 9 p.m. when Claudia Winkleman greets a group of celebrities as they arrive in the Scottish Highlands to play the game of backstabbing and detection. Then there's comedy film drama at 10.15. when Amy Lou Wood stars in Film Club. Over on BBC Two at 7.30 p.m, it's Jules and Greg's Wild Swim, followed by Tropic of Cancer with Simon Reeve at 8 p.m, when the adventurer embarks on a journey round the northern border of the tropics. Stay with BBC Two for Britain's nuclear bomb scandal at 9 p.m, an investigation into the devastating effects of the UK government's post-war nuclear test programme in Australia and the South Pacific during the 1950s and 60s. The Hack continues over on ITV1 at 9 p.m. when Nick must form new alliances as he protects his newspaper from a Fleet Street backlash. Toby Johns stars. Channel 4 has Britain's Most Expensive Homes at 10 p.m. featuring a house on North London's Billionaire Row. Now for Thursday. Amanda Holden and Alan Carr are let loose again at 2.30 p.m. on BBC One in Amanda and Alan's Italian Job. This time they're trying to renovate a 17th century kitchen. BBC One's evening schedule offers Dragon's Den at 8 p.m. including a prehistoric pitch for educational dinosaurs, followed by part two of the Celebrity Traitors at 9 p.m. International football dominates BBC Two and ITV One with live coverage and commentary of Scotland versus Greece at 7.30 p.m. on BBC Two, whilst ITV One has England versus Wales at 7 p.m. Film fans might prefer to stay up for Batman Begins at 10.50 on ITV1, an action fantasy starring Christian Bale as Batman Bruce Wayne. There's a bit more variety over on Channel 4, who offer George Clark's Homes in the Wild at 8 p.m, in which the architect visits remote Rakino Island off New Zealand's Hauraki Gulf. This is followed at 9 by the reliably entertaining Taskmaster, where the fragile bonds between the celebrity contestants are starting to fray. Night owls might enjoy Gogglebox at 11.20 p.m. when armchair critics share their opinions on what they have been watching this week. And finally, it's Friday. And Holmes Under the Hammer visits Kent and Suffolk at 11:30 on BBC One, while Sonali Shah escapes to the country at 2:45 to meet a couple who have dreamed of owning a property in rural Wales. In between, you can catch Sister Boniface investigating a murder at a radio station in Sister Boniface Mysteries at 2 p.m. Lorna Watson stars as the sleuthing nun. BBC One evening highlights include DIY SOS at 8 p.m. when Nick Knowles and the team transform a terraced house in South Wales. At 9:30 p.m, Alan Partridge continues his quest to fix the nation in How Are You? It's Alan. There's more international football over on BBC Two at 7:30 p.m, with live coverage and commentary as Northern Ireland take on group leaders Slovakia at Windsor Park, followed by the gentle wit and wisdom of Bob and Paul in Mortimer and Whitehouse Gone Fishing at 10 p.m. This week, the duo visit Loch Ness in search of the legendary monster. ITV1 has part two of crime drama Borderline at 9 p.m. Detectives Boyd and Reagan investigate the discovery of a body on a Northern Ireland beach. Light Affair on Channel 4 with The Great British Bake Off and Extra Slice. Joe Brand and Tom Allen digest Pastry Week, followed by Gogglebox at 9 p.m. with more armchair criticism. Then there's Friday Night Comedy with the final episode of offbeat sketch show Mitchell and Webb Are Not Helping at 10 p.m. Rounding off the evening with Greg Davis as the reliably amusing comedian takes to the stage at the Lowry in Salford. And that concludes this week's AD TV listings. Hopefully there is something here for everyone.
Now, the radio listings for the 7 days beginning 4th of October, compiled by Wendy and read by Gilly. Starting with Saturday, the 4th of October. Today's drama is The Last of England by Neil McKay on Radio 4 at 3 p.m. The real comedy controllers, The Things That Made Us Laugh, brings us favourite moments from the post-war comedy archive. This first of four programmes features Stars of Variety and the Second World War on Radio 4 Extra at 3 p.m. and 9 p.m. The Escape Artist tells the story of Rudolf Ferber, who with a friend escaped Auschwitz to reveal the truth about the Holocaust on Radio 4 Extra at 6:30 p.m. Classic FM at the Movies with Jonathan Ross features scores from James Bond films on Classic FM at 7 p.m. Moving on to Sunday the 5th of October. The Castaway in Desert Island Discs is artist Angela Harding on Radio 4 at 10 a.m. While in an archive edition from 2015, Stephen Fry is the castaway on Radio 4 Extra at 6 a.m, 11 a.m. and 5 p.m. Beasts on the Lawn brings us five tales by H.H. Munro, pen name Saki, set in a gated community for wealthy residents on Radio 4 Extra at 8:50 a.m, 1:50 p.m. and 7:50 p.m. Peanuts at 75 pays tribute to Charles M. Schulz's classic comic strip on its 75th anniversary on Radio 4 at 7:15 p.m. The Artificial Composer, Music and AI explores the collision of classical music and artificial intelligence on Radio 3 at 7:15 p.m. In Just One Thing with Michael Mosley, this week Michael encourages us to enjoy oily fish on Radio 4 at 7:45 p.m. Kate Adey presents From Our Own Correspondent on Radio 4 at 9:30 p.m. Turning now to those programmes which are broadcast at the same time every day from Monday to Friday. A Carnival of Animals
explores the remarkable stories of 20 endangered animals in a series of 5-minute programmes, starting today with the orangutan, on Radio 4 at 10:55 a.m. every day. A Spanish Lover is a dramatisation of Joanna Trollope's 1993 novel about twins Frances and Lizzie, whose lives take contrasting paths. It's on Radio 4 Extra at 6:30 a.m, 11:30 a.m. and 5:30 p.m. Monday to Friday. The book of the week is Fly, Wild Swans, Jung Chang's sequel to her novel Wild Swans, charting her path from arriving in the UK as a student in 1978 to the present day. Radio 4 at 11:45 a.m. Monday to Friday. In And When Did You Last See Your Father?, Blake Morrison reads his tribute to his cantankerous father, a GP from Yorkshire. Radio 4 Extra at 8:30 a.m, 1:30 p.m. and 7:30 p.m. I Am What I Ate is the first of 5 varied programmes this week, commissioned as part of the Multitrack Fellowship for Audio Producers. In this first programme, Chantal Romain tries to recreate her mother's traditional Jamaican cooking in multicultural London. Radio 4 at 1:45 p.m. each day this week. The composer of the week is Eleanor Alberger, born 1949, on Radio 3 at 4 p.m. The book at bedtime is Helm by Sarah Hall, on Radio 4 at 10:45 p.m. Monday to Friday. Here are some individual programmes to listen to through the week, starting with Monday the 6th of October. In the series Great Lives, the subject is Oliver Postgate, who created some of the most enduring worlds and best-loved characters in television, on Radio 4 at 3 p.m. There's an edition of Just a Minute on Radio 4 Extra at 2 p.m. and 8 p.m, while another panel show, The Kitchen Cabinet, ends its current series on Radio 4 at 4:30 p.m. Historian Mary Beard's series, Being Roman, continues with A Bag of Snails and A Glass of Wine, looking at Pompeii's pub culture. It's on Radio 4 at 11:30 p.m, and the series continues tomorrow and Wednesday at the same times. Some suggestions for Tuesday the 7th of October. In History's Toughest Heroes, actor Ray Winston charts the stories of 20th century adventurers, starting this week with the Danish explorer, anthropologist and author, Peter Frøyken. Radio 4 at 3 p.m. In Ways of Not Seeing, blind writer Joseph Rizzo-Naudi explores how new approaches to describing art can bring galleries and museums to life for everyone, on Radio 4 at 4 p.m. In WhatsApp Docs this week, Drs. Chris and Zan van Tulliken examine how nature benefits mental and physical health and how to make the most of it, even in urban environments. Radio 4 at 4:30 p.m. Peter White brings us his regular programme In Touch, with news and information for people who are blind or partially sighted, on Radio 4 at 8:40 p.m. Moving on to Wednesday, 8th of October. In File on 4 Investigates, reporter Chris Marston spends time with the Youth Justice Service in Swindon to find out how it rehabilitates young offenders, and asks if the success of the youth system could help address overcrowding in adult prisons. Radio 4 at 11 a.m. There's Vintage Comedy, with an episode of Hancock's Half Hour from 1958, on Radio 4 Extra at 7:30 a.m, 12:30 p.m. and 6:30 p.m. The literary quiz, The Right Stuff, starts a new series today at 2 p.m. and 8 p.m. Choral Evensong comes from St. Peter, Bolton Lemoore's, on Radio 3 at 3 p.m. In the Life Scientific, material scientist Eleanor Schofield looks at the challenges of studying and protecting ancient wooden warships and the enlightening process of conserving the Mary Rose on Radio 4 at 9 p.m. Then on Thursday, the 9th of October, in the Landscapes of Don McCullin, the celebrated photojournalist discusses how, after 60 years covering wars and tragedies, he found his salvation in the Somerset landscape, on Radio 4 Extra at 10:30 a.m. and 4:30 p.m. In this cultural life, composer Thomas Addis reflects on his inspirations and discusses the formative influence of regularly attending the ENO, that's on Radio 4 at 11 a.m. Dead Relies is the third of four plays written for Maureen Lipman in the series A Month of Maureen on Radio 4 Extra at 8 a.m, 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. A new series of ramblings begins this week with comic Mark Steele joining Claire Balding for a walk around Hambleton Peninsula in Rutland on Radio 4 at 3 p.m. BBC Inside Science is on Radio 4 at 4:30 p.m. Radical with Amal Rajan offers his take on the week's news on Radio 4 at 11 p.m. And so to Friday, 10th of October. The series Soul Music today brings us responses to Nessun Dorma from Puccini's opera Turandot, with contributors including Pavarotti's daughter, Christina, on Radio 4 Extra at 10 a.m. and 4 p.m. Siblings is the first episode of The Betrayed, a dark five-part drama set in Ireland. Louise, a senior detective, is forced to choose between her wayward brother Frank and the rule of law, on Radio 4 at 2:15 p.m. In the series Short Works, Ada Player reads The Victim, detective comedy, on Radio 4 at 3:45 p.m. The comedy panel show The News Quiz continues its run on Radio 4 at 6:30 p.m. Any questions? From York St John University is on Radio 4 at 8 p.m. Enjoy your listening week.
TNS Soundings.
TNS Soundings.
Hello, this is Nikki with an article written by Fiona entitled Could an App from Ukraine Reduce Eye Strain? Is our increasing use of mobile phones, laptops and other screens affecting our vision, causing eye strain and physical discomfort? If this is something which concerns you, the work of a startup group in Odessa, Ukraine, may be of interest. Many people worry that viewing a screen often and for long periods can damage their eyes, but according to the College of Optometrists in London, there is no evidence of this. The Royal National Institute of Blind People, RNIB, agrees, stating that you can't harm your eyes by using a computer. They say computers don't cause permanent changes to your eyes or make eye conditions that you may have any worse. But some people remain worried that the blue light emitted by screens is harmful. On the positive side, both the RNIB and the Macular Society agree that inside the human eye, the lens filters out a lot of the light before it reaches the light-sensitive cells of the retina, so the exposure is much reduced. However, all agree that eye strain is common after heavy screen use. WebMD, an American corporation which publishes online news and information about human health and well-being, explains that eye strain is a common condition. It's not unusual to experience eye strain after spending a long time reading, looking at a computer, tablet or smartphone, or even driving. This means after heavy screen time, your eyes start to feel tired or sore, itchy or blurred. You may also develop a sore neck and shoulders. Most cases of eye strain are temporary and disappear after you've taken a break and rested your eyes. The good news is that in cases where eye strain is bothering you, there are easy exercises you can do to help relieve it. That's where a group of technicians and ophthalmologists in Ukraine have stepped in to help. They have developed an app which combines therapeutic exercises and games, making the process of eye strain both simple and fun. The Hillel Computer School in Odessa, a port city in Ukraine, is hosting the work, which is aimed at office workers, programmers, children and teenagers, and people who notice a decrease in vision. A year and a half ago, ophthalmologist Alexander Atmanov came up with the idea of creating a useful service that would help gadget users check their eyesight. Now, Alexander and his colleagues are working to improve vision in what they describe as conditions of digital overload, with research showing users spending on average up to 9 hours a day looking at screens. I'm an ophthalmologist working with both adults and children. My experience with mass screening and work at the Institute allowed me to see how widespread vision problems are, as well as the importance of prevention and timely diagnosis, Alexander explained. The initial idea was for mass vision screening in various educational institutions or offices, but later we realised that it was much more effective to implement it via a smartphone, supplementing the functionality with training capabilities and personalised recommendations. Called Roundel, the app is being tested at the moment by early adopters, including ophthalmologists, children at risk of myopia, gamers and office workers. This allows developers to get feedback and improve and personalise the training techniques. The next stage of testing will involve expanding the audience through partnerships with clinics, educational institutions and e-sports teams. This will allow Roundel to be fully adapted to the needs of individual users. Co-founder of Roundel, Igor Romanenko, is responsible for operational management and communications. He said, "Next steps in the development of the project will involve local testing and an initial launch and analysis of results on the Ukrainian market. After successful local testing, entry into the European and US markets is planned. We wish the team all the very best in their work. In the meantime, you may like to check the WebMD website, which has simple exercises for eye strain. If you go to the website www.webmd.com, enter the term eye strain in the search box to find the exercises, or use TNF's special shortcut web link, which is tnflink.uk/12k, all lowercase. That's tnflink.uk/12k.
TNF Soundings.
News and information from Sandwell Council. Sandwell prosecutes perpetrator of housing fraud. A woman from Rowley Regis who attempted to acquire a council house from Sandwell while owning an address in Birmingham has been sentenced to 100 hours of unpaid work and a fine of over £1,800. She provided false information on the Sandwell housing application, claiming she was about to be made homeless, whilst continuing to rent out the home she already owned to tenants. Sandwell Council have released the details in order to make it clear that they will take tough stance on housing tenancy fraud at a time of high demand for council properties from people in real need of housing. This follows on from a recent announcement that since April 2023, Sandwell Council has successfully prosecuted 30 cases of blue badge fraud. This includes 25 prosecutions and 18 warning letters since April 2024, demonstrating the increased efforts to curb the problem over the past year. The trial was held on Friday the 19th of September at Dudley Magistrates Court. As well as being sentenced to unpaid work, the individual was ordered to pay nearly £2,000 and the housing application was cancelled before the tenancy could be obtained. Details of the investigation. An application was submitted to the council, indicated she was living in Sandwell and was in need of accommodation due to her landlord asking her to leave the property she had lived in. The council conducts various vetting checks on all housing applications, and this highlighted there were more inconsistencies with the information that she had provided. This resulted in the matter being referred to the counter-fraud unit for further investigation. The investigation identified that the applicant had links to another address outside the borough, and it was proven that she owned the address, which she had purchased through the right to buy scheme from another council, Birmingham. The ownership of this property had not been declared on the housing application when asked a direct question about property ownership or when she was required to provide her address history. Instead, she failed to list the property as one of her previous addresses in attempt to cover up the ownership. The housing application was cancelled prior to any tenancy being obtained. Court proceedings were initiated. She initially pleaded not guilty at earlier hearings. On Friday the 19th of September 2025, a trial was heard at Dudley Magistrates Court. The individual was found guilty under the Fraud Act 2006. She was ordered to pay costs of £1,710.52 and £114 victim surcharge, as well as being sentenced to 12 months community order imposed with the requirement to complete 100 hours of unpaid work.
Better Slippers Project helps Sandwell residents stay safe and confident on their feet. More than 140 Sandwell residents have benefited from the Better Slippers pilot project. Funded by Sandwell Council's public health team, the initiative has supported local people living with mobility issues, providing them with high-quality slippers that are comfortable, easy to wear, fitted with non-slip soles, and designed to reduce the risk of slips, trips, and falls. The risk of falling increases with age, with around 1 in 3 people over 65 in the UK experiencing a fall each year. Falls remain the largest cause of emergency hospital admissions for older people and can have a significant long-term impact on health and independence. By providing safe, supportive slippers, the project aims to help reduce these risks, not only in the home, but when people are out and about. Residents who received the slippers said they felt more stable and confident, which in turn improved mobility and encouraged greater physical activity. The slippers have been distributed through local organisations, including Age UK Sandwell, the Alzheimer's Society, St Albans Community Centre, West Bromwich African Caribbean Resource Centre, Worley Road Surgery, and several other community groups across the borough. Councillor Jackie Taylor, Sandwell Council's Cabinet Member for Adult Services, Health and Wellbeing, said, "Falls can have a devastating impact on people's health and independence, but they are often preventable. This project is making a real difference by helping residents feel safer, steadier, and more confident in their daily lives. It's fantastic to see community groups across Sandwell coming together to support older people and those living with mobility issues." The council is currently exploring future funding and sponsorship opportunities to ensure the continuation of the scheme.
That last piece about those slippers, which I've never come across, was on the Sandwell website a day or so ago, so I slipped it in there with the help of one of our intelligent voices. Well, this next piece I thought I'd include, because it's not of direct interest to this area, but it might be interesting for those who like going to theatres and having touch tours and audio description.
TNS Soundings.
Hello and welcome from me, Chris Beswick. I recently went to see the play Dear England at the Lyric Theatre on Salford Quays. It's the story of how Gareth Southgate set about changing the culture and attitudes in the England men's football team. When I read information about the production on the theatre website, I saw that they were offering touch tours. These tours take place on the stage, before the performance and allow blind and visually impaired audience members to touch costumes, props and set designs as a way of connecting with the production, understanding it better and enjoying it more. I went along to the Lowry and talked to Tim Manley, Head of Communications, to find out more. But before we talked about the touch tours, I began by asking him how this provision fitted in with the theatre's wider policies and strategies to promote access and inclusion.
Yeah, so we want to make visiting Lowry as easy and as comfortable as we can for all visitors. And obviously that includes those with disabilities. So one of the initiatives that we did here is set up a cross-departmental group called the Access Steering Group. And that group involved representatives from every department across Lowry, from technical, programming, marketing, front of house, catering, that looks of all elements of the visit, from pre-visit information all the way through to the end of the visit, and looks at how we can improve that process at every step. And that group shares a commitment to creating a safe and inclusive place for disabled people at Lowry. We have accessible performances, which include touch tours and audio described performances, as well as also captioned BSL interpreted performances, relaxed or sensory adapted performances, those for people with PMLD, and also we're just introducing dementia friendly performances as well.
You touched there on audio description. I think some of our listeners, they'll be familiar with that from their television, but perhaps not necessarily in terms of how it works in the theatre. Just can you explain a little bit more how audio description works at the Lowry?
Visitors who are accessing the audio description can either access it through our own headsets that we provide or through their own technology if they have it. The audio describer is watching the performance at the same time, and we use a regular suite of people. We have one person we use more than any others, but some companies will also have their own audio describers that they use, and in the most unintrusive way they enable the visitor who can't see or isn't able to see all of the action on the stage to get the full appreciation of what's happening.
So touch tours, in a minute you're going to outline, I think, how they work. What inspired you to introduce them in the first instance? Was there a trigger for that?
I think our guiding principle is that theatre shows are for everyone. Audio description has been around a long time. We've been doing them since we first opened. I worked at the Library Theatre in the 90s, and we were doing audio description then. But as a standalone, while the audio describer can do their best, the addition of the touch tour brings to life the scenery, the set, the ambience of the stage in a way that perhaps it takes beyond what you're able to describe by being able to touch some of those key props and elements of the stage.
Yeah, so that's the essence. People go on the stage and there are things there that have been presumably very carefully chosen that you think are going to enable people, as we keep saying, really, to understand what's going on and access it and enjoy it.
The process works. You book it separately to your theatre ticket, but it's free. But that's so we know who's coming and are able to manage that. So for a audio described performance, there's the ticket booking and then you book onto the touch tour. It takes place, generally speaking, 1 hour before the start of the performance and lasts about 20 to 30 minutes, depending on the show. So if it's a half past seven show, it'll be at 6:30 usually. And that gives time for the cast and the stage crew to reset for the start of the production, the opening of the house at 7:00. And different companies do it differently, but generally speaking, the company will select the key objects, bits of scenery, bring them out onto the stage, or sometimes in backstage areas as well, and we'll have a script prepared to describe those key pieces of props, costumes, scenery, and also to give perhaps a little bit of a synopsis as well of what might happen within the place, so people are able to contextualise and place those objects that they're touching within the context of the play.
You're explaining that audio descriptions been around quite a long time, hasn't it? This is something newer. Did that involve training for the staff who are actually directly providing the touch tour?
Yeah, so there's two elements to that. The Lowry is a receiving house. So we don't make our own shows here. So the touch tours are generally offered for, and the audio described performances for shows that are in for a week, and they're on tour. So we wouldn't necessarily have the expertise and that knowledge. So we work with the visiting companies. If they don't offer touch tours, we'll encourage them to do that and work with them and give them the benefit of our own experience. Our role is in the training of the staff who are doing the welcome, the guiding, and then the actual audio describer, who generally speaking will know us really well. So it's our own volunteers who are facilitating the tour, ensuring that it runs smoothly, and then it'll be somebody from the company, the stage manager or another member of their team, who is delivering the detail in terms of the bits of the props and costumes and things that we're looking at.
I wonder if you had any feedback from people who've taken part in them and what kind of feedback it was, and whether we got a sense that, wow, that has made a difference.
Oh, 100%, yeah. Those that come always really enjoy them and always say that it really enhances their enjoyment of the production. We're also always seeking feedback on how we can improve, and we're constantly tweaking, working on small adjustments to improve them all the time. But yeah, the feedback is always really, really positive that it makes a huge difference to how people's sense of what the show is when it's happening on stage, and they know that the main character is going to be wearing a particularly gorgeous dress or an incredible headdress because they've touched it and been able to get up close to it. They've got a sense of it.
Are there any particularly useful collaborations that you've got, contacts with either an individual or an organisation that supports blind or visually impaired people that help you to improve your offering?
Allen is our access ambassador. We employ him, it's only a couple of days a month,
right?
So he's a freelancer,
yeah.
But we work with him to do Michael's role is to spread the message. So he's visually impaired himself, and he's a user of a great fan of Lowry and of our audio described performances. He is a regular theatre goer, and he will go out to visit groups like Henshaw's and other groups and talk about what we're doing, but also sits on our access steering group and advises us on things when we're getting it wrong. Yeah, and it's only a couple of days a month that he works for us, but those couple of days a month are invaluable because he comes along he already comes to lots of performances anyway, and it's great for him because he used to come to loads of shows. He comes to even more shows, but he will chat to anybody who's booking onto the access performances, whether it's, he doesn't come to all the BSL ones, but he'll come to so many of the audio described ones and chat to people who are here already about what their experience is like, so he can keep advising us on improving, but then also goes out and visits groups. He does a few shows. There was a show in Bolton recently. I can't remember what the name was. I meant to look it up. A vision showcase or something. And he did one in Macclesfield the other week, where they're like an exhibition for all sorts of all manner of sensory adaptations and things. But he'd go along and have a little stall for us there.
And are there any plans to expand the provision? I mean, it sounds as though you're already doing an awful lot.
We're very, perhaps rigid is too strong a word, but we certainly encourage all visiting companies to offer this, to offer the touch tours. One of the developments that we're looking at, which is working with some of the smaller companies in the mid-scale. So this is for our Lyric shows where we're able to do it. When we're working with some smaller companies who perhaps aren't in for a whole week or are working in a smaller theatre, if they haven't got an audio described performance, lots of companies are looking at things like integrated access, audio description as part of their show captions, and then in those cases, looking at how we can build in touch tours into some of those as well.
So if you were talking to colleagues in other theatres, your view would be go for it, that this is something that really does make a difference, the touch tour.
Absolutely. Yeah. I wanted to have the stats in front of me, but I didn't have time to grab them this morning. But we know that we have a good proportion of visitors who with disabilities, and a good attendance for our audio described performances and for our touch tours. And the feedback is superb from them as well. So it's something that we would absolutely recommend to anybody to do. Yeah. One of the things I wanted to mention is that we operated through what we call our access register, which is whereby visitors who have any extra needs will register with us. It means they don't have to, and they become part of the access register. It means they don't have to then, every time they book a ticket, describe what that need is. It's recorded once on their record. It also enables them to be able to book the essential companion free ticket without any questions, without needing to contact us. It's automatically on their customer record. And I would recommend it for any organization to set up something like an access register, because it just makes it so easy for people to be able to book their own tickets. Only need to fill in a form once. It all makes it really, really simple.
And if people want to do that, clearly somebody could help them in terms of an internet form. Can they ring in though and get themselves put on the register?
Three ways to register.
Right, that's the important thing to explain that.
On the website, it's thelowry.com/access, and that takes you straight to the access page where you can register. We have an dedicated access phone line, and we have two dedicated staff in the box office. So there's always somebody there who is trained in order to be able to help people to register, just in case it's useful. It's 0161 876 2183. And also a dedicated email of access@thelowry.com.
Tim, thank you very much for your time this morning, that we really appreciate. And thank you for this amazing piece of work. There are three different ways there of getting involved in this and taking advantage of it. So thank you very much.
TNS Soundings.
Albion Match Report. Josh Madger scored his first goal for 9 months to lift West Bromwich Albion back into the Championship's top six and condemn Norwich City to a fourth successive home league defeat. The Albion striker, making only his third start of 2025, scored in the 20th minute to put Ryan Mason's side back on the winning trail following 3 games without a victory. Defeat for Norwich means Liam Manning's sides have won just 2 of their opening 8 Championship games and sit just 2 points above the drop zone in 19th spot. Norwich had their chance to get something out of the game. Emiliano Marcondes went close in the first half, with Harry Darling's header sailing just wide around the hour mark. But Baggies goalkeeper Josh Griffiths produced some excellent second-half saves to deny the hosts. Despite late Norwich pressure, Albion held on for their third away win of the season. A subdued opening was brought to life when Madger, back in Albion's starting line, up at the expense of Orn Hegbo, found Sammy Ling Jr. on the right flank. The on-loan winger swept past his man and sent in a low cross that was not fully cleared. Isaac Price was alive to the threat, delivering a low cross from the right that Madger converted at the far post. Norwich's best chance of the opening 45 minutes came during injury time, when Marcondes' header took a deflection requiring a routine save from Griffiths. The Canaries pressed for an equaliser after the break, and a poor challenge by Jason Malumbi on Josh Sargent presented Marcondes with an opportunity to try his luck from 20 yards, but his free kick was parried away by Griffiths. Matic Jurasek's set piece then found the unmarked Darling, whose header and Griffiths at full stretch but squirmed just wide. Griffiths was to produce an even better save than his earlier effort in the 83rd minute, when Jovan Makama stretched to get on the end of a cross, only to see his header superbly saved. The hosts went close from the resulting corner, only for Chris Meffam to clear off the line in a crowded penalty area. The Albion keeper performed miracles again in the 89th minute, when he spread himself to keep out Ant Cranach's effort at the far post. The Norwich man must have thought he was about to score the equaliser, only to see Griffiths produce a superb save at point-blank range. Albion almost wrapped up the points with a second goal in stoppage time, as substitute Hegbo stretched to send a low Price cross just wide. Ryan Mason said. It was an amazing effort to keep a clean sheet on the road, which isn't easy to do, and we had to suffer. Josh had a big couple of moments at the end. There was a real togetherness and a fighting spirit to see out the game. I think performance-wise, they probably played a better game than us, created more chances, but we had to ride our luck and had to have people produce big moments to keep a clean sheet. But that happens in football.
To wind up this edition, a short extract from the talk, very interesting talk we had from Peter Clovier, who was a journalist with the Express and Star some 30 years ago. Things have moved on a bit since then, and so has he. But I put a question to him at the end about the lack of local news in the paper, and his answer, I suppose, was pretty obvious, and I really should know why we don't get more local news in the Express and Star, because after all, it's meant to be entertaining as well as giving people news. But here's what Peter said.
The fact is that local news, because of our phones, it all goes down to our phones. If you see a road accident, you'll take a picture or not, or you'll text your family or your friend. People, you go to any kid out there and they'll see some news and they'll share it with their mates on Facebook or on WhatsApp or whatever. So they won't tell the local newspaper, but they will put it on a Facebook group. And I guarantee there is a Wednesbury community Facebook group. I guarantee there are loads of West Bromwich Facebook groups. There are WhatsApp groups. There's an app called Nextdoor, and people, that's all about missing cats and dogs. But there will be places that people share news. The problem is, A, finding them, and B, knowing whether any of them are true or not, whether it's just completely made up. And if someone says, oh, I heard that, you know, Mrs. Smith down the road beat her husband to death with a leg of lamb last night, is it true or not? You don't know. Whereas you always know the Express and Star is true. So the answer is, where is the news is still being shared, but it's being shared online and on platforms like Facebook and Instagram and WhatsApp. It's just not being shared at the local newspaper. And I don't know what you do about that, other than go onto them and find them. But essentially, news is more of, it's so much more visual nowadays, isn't it? People share a picture and write a caption rather than bother to tell a story. Or they just do a video. And I mean, that's what, you know, why is TikTok doing so well? Because it's easy, you just point and shoot. About staying in contact with people, Peter Rose must be about 1,000 years old now. He was close to retirement when I joined. Good for him, frankly, that he still goes, Mark Andrews, no, but we never great mates at the time. But he's a funny, grumpy old guy. I do occasionally hear from someone. There's a bloke called Dan Slee, who I work with on the at Black Lake. He now works for Dudley Council, and I occasionally send him rude messages on Facebook. And Philippa Thompson, the one who's on GB News, we commiserated about that when she got fired. So I do stay in touch with them a bit, because you get this bond, you know, of you feel like you're in the trenches, and even though people have long departed and it was 25 years ago, as soon as you mention Firkins, people are like, oh, I remember, oh, brilliant, yeah, fantastic. And people will put, there's a Facebook group of remembering the Express and Star. There's loads of old groups of like, we were on the Express and Star back in the day. And so you do hear what's going on. Yeah, sorry, go on.
Chris Lebowski is still about doing reports on the Albion.
Is he?
He was Express and Star originally.
He was, yeah, that's true. There are, it's funny, there's a bloke I work with whose dad, called Guy Warman, whose dad is Bob Warman. And you remember Bob Warman from ITV? And he, Guy and I were chatting about working in the Midlands, and he's like, Bob only retired when he got so sick of all the kids on ITV News just not knowing the area and saying, this is a story, and Bob would go, no, it's not, it's boring. I know these people, they won't care about this. People, when they start off in journalism here, they stay and you get that real affection. So I'm not surprised that he's still staying here. And also, with the Albion, I mean, that's a story that keeps on giving, isn't it? It's never not going to be entertaining. And I saw Nick Owen at a wedding recently, who's on Midlands. Nick Owen, Midlands Today bloke? Yeah, he's still going. And he's got that same thing of like, you might leave, but you never really leave. It stays with you. But yeah, so I don't know where you find, I don't know, where do people, I mean, ask your grandkids where they share, local news, and that'll be where to find it. It's not the Express and Star anymore, sadly. What can you do? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I will be including extracts from Peter's talk, which lasted an hour or more, but that's all we've time for now. Thought it might explain why we go to some lengths at times to explain the pictures, the visuals in Express and Star, because things are much more visual than they used to be. Here's Pam with the usual round of thanks.
Thank you to all our volunteers who've read the Express and Star articles for us this week. Mia, Jan, Gavin, Linda, Alison, who was covering for Janet, who's away. Thanks also to me for covering for Trevor, who's away. I just want to add the thanks to myself because Sandra left us a message on the message service saying that I never thank myself. So I should. So Sandra, this thanks to me is from you. Thanks also to Sarah Ann for doing the quiz, Sue for picking the articles, Cyrita for doing all the uploading to the website and the Talking News Federation platform. Thanks as usual to Ray for all his hard work putting everything together and to Tony and Gavin for putting everything onto the USB sticks and CDs so that they can go out in the post to you all. Well, have a lovely week, everyone. It's definitely autumn, isn't it now? And we'll be looking forward to some rain, perhaps.
Yes, indeed. Perhaps we will have some rain to look forward to, Pam. Don't know that we usually look forward to rain, but we do need it. And it's certainly been colder for a few days recently. I've been busy entertaining a friend for the last few days. Hope we'll be going out for a meal this afternoon. That's the end of this edition. And if you've any comments, Sandra was certainly on the mark, thanking Pam for all she does. And she's too modest to thank herself, of course. That is it for this week, then. We'll be back as October progresses and we move towards Christmas and all that, and so the time goes by. But for now, it's bye bye from me, Ray, all the team for this week, but we'll be back with you, of course, next week. Bye for now.
To use our talk phone service to listen to Sandwell Talking News or leave us a message, phone 0121 699 6696. If you are using a landline in the 0121 area, then just dial 699 6696.